My name is Paul Holden-Graeber, and I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library. You've heard me say this so many times. My goal here at the library is to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and when successful, to make it levitate. I would like to quickly tell you about our upcoming live season. About 6 or 7 months ago, I asked the designer of my live series to come up with a new kind of menu. And he took my suggestion quite literally. So I invite you to look at the menu. And if you like martinis, you might like to come and hear Angela Davis and Toni Morrison. Tacos, Edwidge Danticat. Steak, of course, Lady Antonia Fraser. Asparagus, A Night with the National Lampoon. Pizza, Derek Walcott. Wine, Zadie Smith. Shrimp, Antonio Damasio with Marina Abramovitz. Cupcakes, quite naturally, Jay-Z. And bananas, Keith Richards. Keith Richards will be here on the 29th of October, and tickets will go on sale day after tomorrow. I would like to tell you that Keith Richards said something very interesting in my mind. He said that when he was a child, and I'm sure you will understand that you will guess the end of this sentence, when he was a child, he wanted to be a librarian. He said that growing up in England, there were two institutions that mattered to him terribly much. The church, which belongs to God, and the library, which belongs to the people. The library, he said, is a great equalizer. On the basis of that, I invited him to come to the library and to talk to us about his childhood desires. I would like to encourage all of you to become friends of the library for just $40 a year, which is a pretty cheap date. You will get discounts on all live tickets and much more. And you will also find out about new events that are coming up now. You will see on your chair a new announcement with the word face on it, and you will be able to come, for instance, to hear the Slovenian philosopher on the 9th of November, Slavoj Žižek. Tonight's program is being telecast in real time by Fora TV, so anyone can be live for the conversation by tuning in online. To access a live stream, you simply go to HTTP. I feel very embarrassed saying this because I have three tech people here. /fora.tv. In a world of rapidly accelerating change, Stephen Johnson writes, from iPads, that I understand, to e-books, that I understand, to genetic mapping, I understand a bit less, to maglev trains, I don't know at all what I'm saying just now. We can't maglev trains. When he sent me that, I thought, my goodness, I invite smart people. We can't but help wonder if technology is our servant or our master, and whether it is taking us in a healthy direction as a society. What forces drive the steady march of innovation? How can we build an environment in our schools, our businesses, and in our private lives that encourage the creation of new ideas, ideas that build on the new technology platforms in a socially responsible way? To ask these questions, he's asking us to ponder. It is a pleasure to welcome Stephen Johnson back to another Live from the New York Public Library event. He has been here, I think, three, maybe four times. He was quite marvelous with Jeff Tweedy and Lawrence Lessig and Chris Anderson and Shepard Fairey. No, they were not all together that same evening. That would have been quite something. They were on three or four different events that Stephen partook in, and I've had the great pleasure of interviewing him myself on the other coast in Los Angeles. So welcome back, Stephen. And Stephen Johnson and Kevin Kelly will be signing their books after the conversation, which will be moderated or modulated or better yet instigated with vigor and verve. by Robert Krulwich, the co-host on WNYC of the scientific documentary series Radio Lab. So please warmly welcome Stephen Johnson, Kevin Kelly, and Robert Krulwich to the Live from the New York Public Library stage.
So let's just get the introductions done. Stephen Johnson describes himself as the father of three boys, the husband of one wife, and the author of seven books. He is the co-founder also of three websites. He's also a singularly wonderful storyteller, and for years now, in one form or another, he's been thinking about the flow of information. That seems to be a theme with him. He's written about Joseph Priestley, 18th century thinker who influenced Franklin and Jefferson and who jumped from science to religion to politics with enormous ease. And he's also written about computer games and TV and politics and the spread of disease in 19th century London, how ideas propagate, how coffee houses and salons and Twitter link the world. He's helped create one of the first websites to energetically seek out audience participation, and he seems to have a weak spot for maps. I think he loves maps. And one of the newer websites he's developed, Outside In, it's called, they collect and display information based on your zip code. So you punch in your zip, and poof, there's all these stories and tips about the neighborhood that you usually live in, and often by people who live in that neighborhood. He majored in semiotics at Brown, studied 19th century literature at Columbia. He's been a columnist for Discover, Slate, Wired, co-founded an early webzine called Feed Magazine, and his latest offering is a kind of summing up of a lot of the work he's been doing over the past decade. It's called Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. So that's this guy. This guy. It's a bit of a thing to describe Kevin. What do you say about a guy who published and edited the first magazine devoted entirely to walking, and then jumped on a bike and rode 5,000 miles across America, who disappears from time to time to wander through Asia, who helped launch Wired magazine in 93, became its executive editor, and then retired to the post of Senior Maverick. That is literally his title. He's also the editor and publisher of Cool Tools, which is a website that reviews gadgets of all kinds. He's one of those guys who seems to know every cool person in California. So he was on the founding board of The Well, when the internet began way back when. He published and edited the Whole Earth Review. He helped launch the annual Hackers Conference for programmers back, I'm not sure when. He started Cyberthon, which was the first round-the-clock virtual reality jamboree. He hangs around with gurus and venture capitalists and beekeepers. He's a farmer, sort of. Basically, he's the living embodiment of what a good New Yorker would imagine a super geeky Californian to be like if you ever met a real one. And, you know, he kind of looks a little like, you know, Michael. Having written a brilliant book years ago called Out of Control, The New Biology of Machines, he's now got a new one, and it is called What Technology Wants. So that's Kevin. Now. Wow. That's just a weird question, right? I mean, if I met a spoon, I know what it wants. It wants whatever I want. I take it, put it in the soup, bring it to my mouth, suck on it, put it down. When it's down, it's just nothing. It doesn't want anything. So at least that's my notion. So when you ask this question, or actually you don't even ask it, your book title answers it, What Technology Wants. What does that mean?
So I think we tend to view technology by that word generally to mean sort of anything that was invented after we were born, right? Anything that doesn't work yet.
Yeah.
And all this new stuff, this gadget stuff, and stuff that's in our pockets and kind of around our household. But I wanted to look at it, not the individual objects, because as a single object doesn't want really anything, as you're suggesting. I wanted to look at the way in which that object, that iPhone requires, it's about the size of a stone handle hammer that a caveman would have made 10,000 years ago. But unlike that, the caveman could have made the stone handle hammer, but none of us here could make the iPhone. All of us here could not make it. It requires thousands of different technologies to make that one other technology. So there is a web of technologies that are kind of interdependent, co-factoring, interweaving to produce what I think of as sort of a superorganism of technology. It's like a technology superorganism that...
You mean all the spoons, all the forks, all the knives, and all the telephones?
All the telephones, all the factories, all the roads, everything together, and us together form a large entity. And that is what I mean by the technology in the title.
Isn't that slightly overbroad? That's just called everything.
Let's call it everything. And there's very little different from everything, like all culture, except that it is all connected together. So the difference between this kind of everything and culture is the fact that it forms something itself. It forms a new thing that, like other superorganisms, have an emergent kind of agenda that is beyond just the spoon. So the spoon itself is sort of like the bee or the ant in the colony. It doesn't really mean much, but together, all those spoons and everything else connected together, all the little chips, all the wires, all the roads, it does form something that does begin, in a very small way, to have the slimmest bit of autonomy, and autonomy that wasn't there in the individual pieces.
Autonomy and some kind of will?
Well, so want, that's a strong word when I use the word want, because we immediately think of what you want and what I want and say, it's deliberately thinking about, what do I want? But I mean want in the way in which that flower, when it was alive,
it's sort of hanging on.
Wanted light. And so it kind of leans towards the light a little bit. It's has a drift. It has a tendency towards the light. It's not intelligent. It's not conscious. But the plant itself wants light. It leans towards the light. So the technium, which is the word I use to distinguish this whole superorganism of technology, it's leaning in certain directions. It has certain tendencies as any large complex system. And so it wants to go in certain directions.
We'll get to the directions where it may want to go. Let me ask you, your question is a little more modest than his.
I aim a little lower. It's been my career path is to aim just a little lower than Kevin. Figure out where Kevin is going and just steer right underneath that.
So your question is where do good ideas come from? So for you, let's just make sure, since he's got all spoons and forks becoming a technium, I just want to make sure we're on. Yours is, let me look at the word idea. For you to use that word, what do you mean?
Well, I kind of deliberately didn't use the word innovation in the main title, because although it is in the subtitle of the book, because that word is a word that has kind of been co-opted by, you know, business theory management books and things like that. And while it's relevant to what I'm talking about in the book, I wanted it to be bigger. So I wanted it to be everything from, you know, scientific breakthroughs, technological breakthroughs in the creative arts, and also just kind of ordinary breakthroughs in our lives where we have a good idea that helps us kind of live a little bit better, be a little bit better in our jobs. Because what I suspected was that there were these kind of underlying shared patterns that in the spaces that led to those good ideas, at the highest pinnacles of science and in the creative arts, and even in natural systems. I mean, this is part of the book that I suppose aims a little bit more on a Kelly-esque kind of level, which is to suggest that there are actually in innovative ecosystems, not just innovative human systems, in nature, there are shared patterns as well. Whenever you see an ecosystem that is being unusually diverse in the kinds of life it supports, that innovation is, I think, powered by the same laws and principles that drive, you know, human innovation.
But when you use the word innovation or idea, so for most people, in the cartoon version, that's the light bulb going on. So right. Some guy is sitting there thinking, bing! And then they think, E equals MC squared, or something like that. So for you, you go into it a little bit into the brain business. For you, when you look into a brain, you don't see anything coming out of nothing. There's something a little bit more.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest things I think you have to kind of undo when you approach a topic like this, which is this idea that the breakthrough idea, the light bulb moment, is a single thing happening in a single mind. And that it happens in an instant. For some reason, we want to tell the story that way. There's this kind of innate desire. I mean, yeah. As a storyteller, I want to tell the story that way, too. And people do tend to build these elaborate fictions about their kind of moments of epiphany. But when you go back and look at the historical record and kind of rewind the tape and play it slowly, and so many of these breakthrough, allegedly kind of breakthrough epiphanies, what you find is, in fact, that the idea was incubating for a very long period of time. It actually builds upon other ideas by other people. It's more of a kind of a remixing of other people's concepts and other people's tools, and it kind of fades into view over a much longer period of time. This is what I call the slow hunch in the book, that it's not this kind of gut impression or this sudden, you know, moment of clarity, but this much more evolutionary, more kind of lingering process.
Well, does that mean that you are suspicious of stories in which somebody goes, aha? Uh-huh. You don't think there really is a real uh-huh?
There are moments where you do have a new perspective on a problem, but it's almost always been, you've been building up to it. I mean, Darwin, there's a story in the book about Darwin. In his own autobiography, tells the story of a classic eureka moment, reading Malthus one night in his library in 1838. And in his autobiography, he says, "And suddenly the idea for natural selection kind of popped into my head, and at last I had a theory with which I could work," was his expression. But then when this great scholar, Howard Gruber, went back and reread all of Darwin's notebooks, and Darwin kept these very copious notebooks where he wrote down all of his ideas and quotes that influenced him, which we may want to talk about later, Gruber found that, in fact, the idea had been there in really full-dress form for 3 months before the alleged epiphany. And then you can see the night he has the epiphany. There are a bunch of exclamation marks in the book and everything. But then the next morning, he goes about his business like nothing has changed. Like he hasn't had the greatest idea in the 19th century kind of scientific tradition. And it's not for another 2 months before he starts writing about his idea like he owns this thing and is trying to figure out what to do with it. And so it's a much slower, even though Darwin said it was a sudden epiphany, and it turns out, because we have all of his thoughts written down, that it was a much slower, more evolutionary process.
Well, do you have the sense that there is never a eureka moment? Or do you have, like, you know, one eureka moment and 50 slow, small intrudes?
I think that there are moments where you do kind of advance in some clear fashion, and you suddenly do see things in a new way. A lot of them come in dreams. Actually, the book talks a lot about how many amazing empirical scientific discoveries actually occur to people in dreams. But I guess part of what I'm trying to do with this argument is to kind of correct that, the emphasis we place on those things. Because if that's what you're looking for, it's almost impossible to set yourself up to have those breakthrough ideas, because you're not thinking about the kind of slow cumulative process.
And the other thing about those eureka moments is that they may, and often usually do, occur to at least 10 other people at the same time, right, which diminishes the eureka-ness of it.
Right. For example,
every single invention that we know about, for example, the telephone, the patents for the telephone, were submitted by Alexander Graham Bell and Gray within 3 hours of each other.
Really?
Yes. And the light bulbs were the light bulb that we associate with Thomas Edison. He was the last of 23 other people.
To mean, there was no light bulb, 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 no light bulb. Then, boom!
Within a matter of a couple of years, light bulbs. Everybody had the light bulb idea. And calculus being independent. And it's not just by two people. It's often by three, four, five, or six people.
What would explain the sudden ubiquity of an idea after a long, eternal silence?
The precursor adjacent inventions that are required for that next step have all been done. So it's like a growth where you need to go through a certain stage to get to the next stage. You have to have all the parts. And because no idea is alone, the light bulb required, you know, whatever it is, 100 other sub-inventions to sustain it, to even conceive of it. And when they're in place, and then it's like the next idea is just there, 10 people have the aha, 20 people have the aha.
But does that mean like that the pharaoh had an assistant named Igbit Achta who sat there in, you know, 4000 BC thinking, I think we ought to have an automobile. And then people would say, And it was a good idea, but there were no tires, there was no motor.
We have a classic example of that. There was a monk in a monastery who was breeding peas, who came up with this theory of inheritance, recessive and dominant, got it completely right. Nothing. Nobody believed it. It didn't make any sense to anybody. And here's this is the interesting part. 35 years later, I think it was four separate independent individuals rediscovered his work in the same year. So the rediscovery of it, the aha, and they all realized, oh, he was right. I mean, it was like, what are the chances of that? So it was just like he was so far ahead that it made no sense. And so being too early with an idea is really is bad or worse than being too late.
And you have a Charles Babbage.
Yeah,
right?
Babbage is a great example of this. So Babbage,
who's he?
In the middle of the 19th century, Babbage is this kind of visionary kind of inventor who really comes up with two primary inventions, the first of which is an extremely advanced calculator for the day called the difference engine, which he did in fact manage to build and which was enough within the kind of boundaries of the period that he was able to influence people's ideas about calculation, and a whole set of profitable businesses ended up being built kind of working on Babbage's ideas. But then he also, shortly after that, came up with really the basic outlines of a programmable computer in the middle of the 19th century with Ada Lovelace, Lord Byron's daughter, who was the first software programmer, which is a wonderful little bit of history.
What does that mean, she was the first?
She was writing the code for this machine that was never quite built.
And how do you write code when you're Byron's daughter?
Well, because you're kind of writing it out. In theory, this is how the software would look if this machine were ever built, right? You have to figure out a language to kind of program it with punch cards, actually, which were brought over from industrial technology.
So she had punch cards?
They were using punch cards in the looms. I mean, punch cards were invented originally for the looms. So Babbage invents this thing, the analytical engine. It's got the whole concept of a CPU, it's got the concept of RAM, it's got the concept of software, all of these things. But a programmable computer basically needs digital age technology. It certainly needs, at the least, it needs vacuum tubes, right? And it does much better when you have integrated circuits and all these things. So he was trying to build a digital era technology with industrial era parts. It was steam powered with like mechanical gears and stuff like that. And it was not, it was never going to fit in your pocket. And it was probably not going to fit on your farm, right? It was going to be so big and so slow. And so what's interesting about it is to Kevin's point exactly, that it wasn't just that it failed, but the idea was so ahead of its time, it had so escaped the boundaries of kind of possibility at that moment, that the ideas actually died out and they had to be independently rediscovered 70 or 80 years later in the 30s and 40s.
70 or 80? Oh, shit, that was that far ahead.
Yeah. I mean, and there was no way to kind of make the leap from this one idea to the other. So we both use this, Kevin and I are both kind of fans of this phrase from Stuart Kaufman, which is kind of the opening chapter in my book, which is this idea of the adjacent possible.
The adjacent possible.
And it's just bear with me. It's a good, it's useful. And the idea is
so
basically,
many syllables.
At any given time, oh, come on, this is a very literary crowd. They can handle the set of syllables. So the idea is at any given time, both in the evolution of life and in the evolution of technology, there are kind of, given the state of the current system, there are a finite set of moves that are possible. So imagine it like a chessboard, right? You're in the middle of a game, there's a certain number of moves that are possible, a much larger set of moves that are not possible. The same is true of technological history. You cannot invent a microwave oven in 1650, just as you cannot invent an automobile in ancient Egypt.
Just to make sure, you could imagine one,
right,
but you can't build it.
Yes, although it is remarkably hard to imagine one. That's part of the point here. I mean, when I saw this in detail in Invention of Air, the book about your friend Joe Priestley, who I like that you're a colloquial friend in terms of him.
He killed a lot of mice.
So Priestley is most famous for inventing oxygen, isolating oxygen for the first time, which is another case of a multiple discovery where three other people kind of discovered it right around the same time independently, more or less. And the point was that they were able to think about isolating oxygen for the first time, partially because there were tools, that there were scales and things that made it easier to kind of realize that this element was there. But the biggest one was a conceptual leap, which is it only had become possible a couple of years before to even think about the air as being something you wanted to investigate scientifically. Up until that point, they were like, well, I want to investigate wood and bodies and hearts and brains and rocks, but
Well, air was pure.
The stuff between all this. Why would I really study that?
Fire,
there's
water,
nothing there, right? You know? Right. And it was because of a number of, partially because they discovered vacuums, where they were like, not the cleaners, but the empty air, the lack of air, that they were like, okay, this is a vacuum, so there must be something in normal air that we can actually study and understand. And so conceptually, that became a platform that enabled Priestley to kind of think in a way, and his compatriots to think in a way that it was much harder to think even 5 decades before.
See, but there's something interesting about this. Both of you have fallen into a habit of thinking where there is a very Darwinian or sort of evolutionary quality to this. So let's hear some of the things in your book. Serendipity, error, the adjacent possible, reusing, repurposing ideas. The history of technology sounds like, for both of you, sounds suspiciously like the history of life.
Right. And I think
I'm very suspicious of this.
You should be, because the Mac does not look like a sunflower. You know, it's very, very, your iPhone is definitely not lichen. But there are tremendous similarities in many ways. And there was a famous evolutionary biologist, Niles Eldredge, or is he still alive? He worked with Stephen Jay Gould, who died. They both came up with a theory of evolution called punctuated equilibrium. Niles' specialty is studying tribalites, and he does that by mapping the morphology of them as they change. He can make kind of
trilobites.
Yeah. He can make trees, genealogical trees, showing them. His hobby is collecting cornets from around the world.
And cornets, as in
exactly, trumpets. And so he uses the same techniques applied to the forms of these, and actually traces out the little heritage trees. And he can show that, to a rough degree, the evolution of these technological forms resemble, in many ways, the kind of tracing of life as it forks and speciates. And so there is one sense in which the things that we make are really just an extension of the same evolutionary processes that made us. And that really shouldn't really be a surprise to us.
Well, do you think that the fact that all these people would suddenly think light bulb together after a long silence suggests that somehow this is happening to us rather than by us? I mean, when the environment is ready, in some sense, then it will happen. So it's almost as if the technium, your phrase, is kind of whispering now.
Right. Yeah. Yes. It is. It is an environment that we're in, and it is.
It's creepy to me.
It is creepy, and it's also, because it's inevitable too. That's also another creepy word that people get spooked by.
Inevitable.
Inevitable. Right.
Do you believe that? Do you believe that a spoon is an inevitable? An inevitable thing that's bound to happen if you're hungry and you invent soup?
Yes, definitely. So the question is I don't think
But that everyone would think of spoon at the same time.
They probably did. But we can't prove it. But we can prove this. And so I looked at the evolution or the sequence of inventions in the continents prehistory before there was very much, or if any, a global trade, any communication between the continents. So basically, inventions that were invented in South America stayed in South America for a long time, same thing with Africa and Asia. And what is remarkable, that to a very high statistical relevance, the sequence of the technologies in those continents was identical. So there's some kind of logic why you might want to make clay first before you made pottery. But there are other things that don't make much sense to us why they would have to happen in this order, but they do. And so there is a sense in which the kind of flow, the sequencing, the development of the technium, the superorganism, follows a kind of a predictable path. And what does that mean? I think it means that there is a restricted channel in which evolutionary systems can go through. They can't just go through anywhere. The big news, the controversial news, is that that's true for life, that there's a direction or a channel. That's kind of a recent idea, or it's actually an old idea that was out of favor, that's back now, that says that there is a direction to evolution. It's not just completely random. And
we'll get back to
Let me
ask you about some, because a lot of your book investigates this terrain. So you talk about the role of serendipity, the role of error, the role of repurposing ideas. Serendipity, for example, where does that pop into this history?
A part of the idea is that if you're trying to have new ideas and to create new things and to explore the possibilities that are out there, one of the best ways to do that is to have surprising encounters with other people, with other ideas, with other tools, and to stumble across things that you weren't expecting. Because when you're caught in a rut of your kind of ordinary life or your kind of traditional research, you're less likely to have some interesting, provocative new breakthrough or some interesting new hunch develop if you're surrounded by the same ideas all over again. I mean, one of the things that the studies that I talk about in the book is this Stanford professor, Martin Roif, who looked at the social networks of unusually innovative people in the corporate world. These are old-fashioned social networks, not their Facebook and Twitter friends, right? And he compared these unusually innovative people to a cohort of unusually not innovative people, which is the side of the experiment you don't want to be on, right? When you're like, could I interview you? You seem very dull. If that's all right. And so what he found...
So where they actually got a group of people who were just so-so?
That's right. And what he found was that there was this very distinctive kind of signature pattern in the kind of makeup of the people that they were friends with or acquaintances with. And that pattern was that they were friends, the innovators were friends with a diverse mix of people in terms of their professions. So they themselves might be a marketing director at an ad agency, but they were friends with an architect and they were friends with a popular science writer and a plumber and a dancer and so on. And the idea was, by having these conversations, instead of just talking to other marketing directors at ad agencies, they were constantly stumbling across stuff serendipitously, where they would just be like, hey, oh, wow, that's interesting. I could take that, and that's a new perspective on a problem, or maybe I could borrow an idea from you here. That, I like the way you just described that. That's kind of a metaphor for thinking about a problem. And so, and I think that's one of the opportunities that the web affords us right now. There is a theory out there, which I've been arguing against, and I think Kevin, for the most part, has been arguing against too, which is that the web, oddly, is this kind of serendipity killing device, or it's this echo chamber kind of filtering device where you only experience exactly what you want to experience. And so it's narrowing the kind of diversity of our media life and eliminating serendipity. And people say this all the time, and whenever I hear it, I think, what medium have you been using? I mean, the web is all about losing 3 hours on Wikipedia, where you're like, I sat down to research a house that I'm thinking of buying, and now I'm reading about monarch butterflies. What happened? Like, where did my afternoon go? You know?
Yeah.
And so I think that
so you think if you gave the dull people, 3 hours with the machine, well, maybe they'd hit on a butterfly?
Here's the thing that drives me crazy is the analogy, and I say this as a longtime user of this institution and a big believer in libraries, when people talk about the death of serendipity online, the story they always say is, do you remember what it used to be like going into the stacks of a library and walking along the stacks and looking for one book, but being intrigued by the spine of a book right by the book you're reading, and having a wonderful experience finding something. And that's great. I've actually done that.
You pull it off the
thing.
But
the percentage of the population that has actually like been struck by the spine of a book in a library, is vanishingly small compared to the number of people who've lost 3 hours on Wikipedia now.
Yeah.
So the thing that's being mourned as being a loss is actually become a mainstream part of my 97-year-old grandmother like surfs the internet, And
uh-huh.
And so I think that there is actually a great capacity for kind of surprise and diversity in these new tools, particularly if we seek it out.
What about, in nature, I guess, the role of serendipity would be the weather changes. It used to be wet. Suddenly it goes dry. A mutation takes place in a creature. There are all kinds of chance events that take place in natural systems that create change.
Every high school student knows that we expect, if we find life somewhere else, we expect it's probably going to involve liquid water and carbon. Right, but why? Well, the answer is that liquid water creates this medium where unusual combinations can serendipitously happen between small elements and molecules. And carbon is particularly important because it's a connector. It forms these very elaborate, rings and lattices with other elements and with itself, and so that when it stumbles across some new element or some other kind of version of itself, it can form this larger shape. And out of enough random collisions, something interesting happens, and people can... It, organisms or proto-organisms can build on top of that.
You probably don't want to go here, but I think it's actually even stronger that if we find life on another planet, it's going to be somewhat DNA-ish related. Right. And that is because, and this is the idea that there is actually channels in which innovation is going through. I think the space of molecules that have the required kind of in-betweenness that DNA does, which allows it to be, is a quasi-crystal, which allows it to be ordered but not to order, to unzip and zip, to replicate, and then to kind of arrange itself to make the splendor of life that we see it. The number of molecules that could do that are probably pretty small, and we might be able to invent some of them, but the number of molecules that can do that and self-organize themselves,
so he's interested
is probably one.
He's interested in surprise and chance, and you're sort of concentrating on, you know what, not everything is possible, and there is physics that seems to be everywhere, and you can't escape, you know, the speed right. of light and that kind of stuff.
Right, and however, having said that, still, even with that restricted channeling of certain things, compared to what could be, maybe everything can't be done, but compared to what we have, it's infinite. In this, you know, relatively infinite.
Well, I'll get to it in just a second, but let me just ask about the role of error. Now, in nature, you know, mistakes, like random mistakes, happen all the time, and that creates all kinds of change. But what do you mean by, in technology, where does an error
There's
create
a
excitement?
Shockingly large number of important scientific discoveries that came out of messy labs where people are just like, I spilled something, I knocked it over, and oh, I discovered X-rays. I mean, it just happens again and again and again. And so there is something, and then there's also in the history of invention, it's not just the idea of kind of, you know, 99% perspiration where you're trying and trying, which is part of it. But it's oftentimes, I would tell the story about Lee DeForest, who's one of the guys who kind of invented the triode and what became kind of the vacuum tube. And in the steps leading up to the discovery of this amazing contraption, which then kind of initiated the electronics, or opened up the space of possibility for electronics, almost every step of the way, he was entirely wrong about what he was doing. He misunderstood it. He misinterpreted the data. But because he was so insistently wrong, and because he kept following his hunches and exploring these things, the wrongness of him kind of it led him into these new avenues, and eventually he kind of got it right at the end of that process. And so, and you know, oftentimes when you look at people in kind of biology labs, there's a guy, Kevin Dunbar, who has gone around and taken the kind of reality TV approach to trying to figure out how innovation happens in science. Where he sets up cameras, you know, videotapes everything, and then watches where the ideas really happen. Do they happen over the microscope, you know, as you're sitting there looking at the tissue sample, or do they happen somewhere else? And what he found is actually most of the real ideas came at the weekly lab meeting at the conference table, when everyone would get around and they would talk shop about what they were doing. And it was often somebody coming in and saying, I'm really stuck, like, I've set this data, set this experiment up wrong, I've got all this noise in my data, and somehow it's been contaminated, or somehow I'm doing it wrong, and I can't figure it out. And it would be somebody, again, to the point of diversity, outside of the experiment, not an expert in that particular field, who would say, hey, you know what, maybe that's interesting, what you found. Maybe that's not a mistake, like, maybe that's signal, not noise. And that would be the big breakthrough, and it would come from realizing that they'd not fully made a mistake, they'd just been interpreting it.
It's even stronger than that, because even when they have the final invention or discovery, even then, usually people don't know what it is. So most of the things that have been invented, the inventors had no idea what it was really going to end up being used for. An example I would use was Edison's invention of the phonograph. You know, it was on discs, these wax discs, and that day or that evenings or those months while he was working on it, he was starting to make a list about what can I use this for? I can record sound. What can I use it for? And so he made a list of what he thought were the most likely uses for it. Number one was to record the requests of the dying. Okay?
To record the requests of the dying.
The last will and testament of the dying. That was his first one. And he had a couple other ones to deliver sermons and things. And down near number 10 was, it probably could record music too. Really? So, it's, I mean, he literally had no idea what this was going to be.
I would
used
have
for.
Thought by now, everybody would just say a heavy breathing, nice looking lady would be good.
Yeah.
Just because the porn always seems to kick things off. But I guess not.
So inventors, even when the whole process is done, still are wrong most of the time.
Well, you have a tale of the World Wide Web, which goes through kind of a wonderful circus of chapters. Mm. You start with some book in 18 something or other. And it ends up in the mind of this guy.
Yeah.
What's that story?
Briefly forgot what you were talking about there, but it's a big book. There are lots of stories, and you don't want to get stumped this early in book tour.
No.
Your own material. I'm sure Kevin wrote about it in his book, too. We can work it out. There was an encyclopedia, a kind of a classic Victorian encyclopedia-like thing called Inquire Within Upon Everything, which was... Basically, you would go and you would say, I'm throwing a dinner party tonight. How should I do the place settings? And there would be a little entry for it. And
so a Margaret Stewart.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and there were kind of editions went on for decades and decades and decades. And one of them made it into, you know, an apartment where a little kid named Timmy Berners-Lee, I've just called him Timmy, but I don't know if his friends called him that.
He used to play with Joey.
Joey Priestley and Timmy Berners-Lee were hanging out. He used to, as a kid, just sit there going through this crazy, dusty tome, reading all these things. And so
he would read about where to place your napkins at a dinner party?
I don't know. I don't want to say anything about Timmy Berners-Lee. But, as a kid, he was interested in that kind of stuff. So years later, he's working basically as a temp at CERN, the Swiss kind of physics lab. And
having worked out his tea party.
That's thought. Right. He keeps saying, we should set the tables differently at the cafeteria. And he's kind of overwhelmed with the number of kind of projects and people that are there. This is in the early 80s, and he's kind of a programmer. And so he decides to create a program to organize all this data, and he works on it for a while, and he calls it, in the memory of this influential tome from his childhood, he calls it Inquire. And he works on it for a while, and it's entirely a side project, right? It's not something he even tells his superiors about at all. And then he puts that away, and then for a while he works on something called Tangle. Like the web could have ended up being called Tangle, actually, if things had played out very differently, which may be a better name for it. And that doesn't really work out.
What doesn't work out?
His idea for it. He actually doesn't write too much code for Tangle, as I recall. But then he starts working on this thing, which involves a couple of other standards that were out there for hypertext, for describing links between pages, and a markup language called SGML. And he builds something that he starts calling the web, or the World Wide Web. And it's only at that point, like 7 years after he'd started, that he goes to his bosses and says, excuse me, I may have invented a whole new medium here. could this be part of my job? Like, you know, I think maybe I should be doing this as, you know. And part of the important...
Wait a second, just so I understand is the word you attach to the thing you're thinking about, if you want to call it Tangle or you want to call it web, that makes a big difference. It tells you, like, what kind of code to write or what your task is or what your goal is. It sounds like he's looking for a word as much as for a user.
Yeah. Well, I think he was... But part of it is it's very hard to conceptualize something that truly has not been invented yet like that. Huh. The idea of a global hypertext architecture was... And there were a few people like Ted Nelson who were visualizing it as well, but it was a very unusual idea. And so he's reaching... Yeah, part of it is reaching for the metaphor to make sense of it. That's a big part of the work. And so I think... I mean, I think with Berners-Lee, part of the lesson is that was a classic slow hunch, right? He had 7 or 8 years to follow this thing. If he had sat down at the beginning and said, I'm going to invent the most important communications revolution of the late 20th century while I'm at my day job, you know, that would have never worked, right? But because he had this kind of freedom and this kind of background process that was he for whatever reason, was able to keep alive, he was able to do it. But the other thing was that he was building on top of the platform of the internet, right? He didn't have to, if he had had to invent the internet, like Al Gore did. Al Gore never said that. That's a lie. If he had had to invent the internet first, it would have never happened because the internet is a very complicated thing to build. But because the internet was out there as this open platform that he could then build on top of without having to ask for permission, it was something that actually one could do, you know, while keeping your day job.
And there's another reason, too, why it worked, which is a little bit what we were referring to earlier as the... One step into the possible adjacent was that his solution was actually very, very simple. Ted Nelson, who had envisioned it years and years before, had a very complicated scheme that was almost impossible to implement. For instance, in his scheme, links went two ways, yeah. right? And so if a page linked to this page, you could follow it back even without knowing where it came from. And that was incredibly hard to implement. And Timbers-Lee's version just went one way so you could have a broken link, which Ted thought was completely unacceptable. But it was simple enough that it was just that one step that was necessary to bring you to the next space.
Well, so nature's like this too. I mean, if you're a fish and you've been sitting in the water but you've been thinking about crawling on the land, you just need to think of one thing called
right.
foot, you know, and... Right. And then you're up. At least so let me ask you.
I think
you,
we're selling you on this.
Yeah. Well, no. But all right. Now let me get a little harder. How far are you willing to push this biology path, Kevin? It seems to me when I read your book, it seems like you almost think that ideas are kind of alive or almost alive. You even say that if you were to look at the living systems of the world, the kingdoms of animals and plants and all those little guys, of which there are six. Mm-hmm. You then, like, in a little map, you plop this technium thing in, so you call it the seventh kingdom.
Yes.
Because the first six are all have mommies and daddies. Right, I'm not right, sure right. how to explain the seventh.
Yeah, so I call it the seventh because I think it is, I place, again, the question I'm asking in a larger context is, what is this stuff that we're making and surrounding ourselves with? It is not just little bunches of gadgets. It's just not wires. It is something much, much bigger. And where does it fit in the cosmos in relation to nature and all the mommies and daddies and other species of the world? Where does it fit into the cosmos and related to stars and galaxies? And so I'm trying to say that it's what really is this thing? And I think when we look at it from afar, and not just the now, the next thing, the next web, but stand back and look at it, we have to see that it's really part of something that's been going on for a long time. That something is this sort of self-organizing thing that is going, not quite against, but is going in contradistinction to entropy, the whole draining of heat into the universe. There's just these little corners where things are winding up while the rest of it runs down. And so,
but there's a very big difference between a spoon and a whale. I mean, a whale meets another whale. Right. They get along. They make a baby whale. That
Again,
baby
don't
whale
think of the spoon. I'm not talking about the spoon. I'm talking about the whole superorganisms of
I
all
know,
the technology.
But it's a lot of spoons.
It's a lot of spoons. And what connects them is actually the fact that these systems tend to self-organize over time, and they
what
share.
What do you mean they tend to self like?
Yes.
Where do you see things, not living things, but right. things self-organizing?
You see that in life. Where did life come from? Okay, smarty pants. Ha, 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 ha. Where did life come from?
I don't know that. Nobody knows that.
Yeah. Well, it's...
But that doesn't mean that spoons are like life. No. I don't think so.
No, they are because it's not spoons, but the technium itself is an extension of the same.
You use the fancy word technium. I'm calling it spoons just so we get on a level playing field. Yeah,
right. What happens is that actually life self-organized from these conditions of planets and stars, which themselves are these unique structures that can persist and maintain their order for billions of years in the face of, again, this entropic heat death that is running down. You have these things maintain their order. Where did that come from? The answer, of course, ultimately, goes back to the Big Bang, and we have this stream of things that are organizing themselves, maintaining order, and in some cases increasing their order in the face of the rest of the universe running down.
But
and the spoons that you're obsessed with have come from that same strand. There is a strand of these galaxies and stars, and here's a little corner of the planet where this self-organizing system has been making more and more order, and it made these animals, and then more and more order and structure and complexity and diversity, and it made minds, and these minds have made another thing that has high degree of order and complexity and stuff, and may itself be starting to make other things. Other minds.
Are you thinking of Mickey Mouse with those brooms that somehow started to multiply? That hasn't happened yet.
No, it hasn't happened yet.
Or here's one where you actually argue against yourself. Here's where technology is definitely not biological. living things go extinct.
Right.
Tools
don't go extinct.
What does that mean?
Okay, so what that means is that there is a difference, as I said, there is a difference between technology and biology. And going back to Niles Eldridge and his little map of the coronets, there was one thing in which there was his little maps were different from his tribalites, and that is that there was lateral heritage. It wasn't just all going up through parents. You could go across time. Some trait could move across time, and that was this serendipitous association of innovation where someone has an old idea and they move it over. So what we find out in the technium is that ideas don't die. They're resurrected. Old tools remain even as we make new tools. So the thing about tools and technology is that we increase our options. We usually add new options to the old ones.
I want to get really concrete about this. You told me on the phone a couple of weeks ago, you had the Montgomery Ward catalog from 1896 to 1895 to 96. We turned to a chapter of the Montgomery Ward catalog called Agricultural Tools, where in people who were shopping for agricultural tools, farmers in 1895 got to look at steel plows, sulky plows, portable platform scales, hail and stock scales, the Maxson lever jack, a number of corn planters, the Chautauqua cornbed seed planter, the Triad cord planter, the Niagara broadcast seeder, the little giant green bone cutter, something which you would hand hold your corn on one side and power it with your other side or something, a number of manure spreaders, a pig iron trough. And you said to me, every one of these items in this catalog, every single one, not only can you find, you can find it being made new today.
Right.
A Niagara broadcast seeder, a little giant green bone cutter. And I said, no way. Right. We have been working now for 2 weeks at NPR trying to find every single one of these idiotic things that seem to be all 19th century, and every one of them is being made new in some place so far. I wanted to come here tonight and slap down some thing, say, ha-ha! But so far, it seems like tools once invented why is this?
It's
well, I mean, these are Mennonites and Quakers and hobbyists and Brazilians and Indian villagers, but somebody's making everything still, always, so far.
Because generally, we have an increasing diversity of things that we want to do, and a lot of what we want to do is what we've always wanted to do. So I don't think, for instance, the book technology will ever go extinct. There will be fewer and fewer books, but it's never going to go away completely because reading is good. You'll feel good. We will always need shoes. As long as we're kind of in these bodies at this scale, we'll need hammers and things like that. So it's no surprise that we can carry them forward because we have we have Lamarckian evolution. So Darwinian evolution is how biology works. But Lamarckian evolution is how technology works. We can actually direct it. We can bring things forward. We can have inherited traits move, acquired traits move forward. So this is what I call the evolution of evolution. So one of the things that we see with life happening is that it's evolving how it evolves. And what technology is doing is increasing the evolvability of evolution. So
are you okay with this?
Yeah, I feel really good about it. Well, here's another. Let me defend.
Put it mildly. Like the thing is, when he says that the tools don't die, he's just. I mean, yeah, he wins the round, but he loses the war because obviously animals and tools do behave differently, and the tools seem to operate on a system that violates the animal rule. They do. Animals do eventually go extinct, but apparently not his tools.
So, you know, he can hear you.
You're okay with this?
Let me defend the Seventh Kingdom a little bit. I mean, I think one of the things that's worth pointing out is they aren't alike in every single way, but I think both Kevin and I feel that by approaching them as though they share a lot of properties, there are new insights that you get from thinking about them in kind of the same space, right? One of the tendencies is the tendency which we kind of alluded to before for systems to explore and expand the adjacent possible, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was Kaufman's original point when he came up with that term. He said there's this long-term trend from these first molecules in the primordial soup to your favorite whales and to a coral reef or rainforest ecosystem. There is just more and more possibility in life. And Kaufman's point is this is clearly true. This has clearly been happening at a steady rate.
But is that a direction? To say that you start with something small and you get larger and then you get larger and you get larger is only to say that's the only way you can't go from something small to something.
It's not getting larger, it's getting more diverse, right?
Well,
and it doesn't. And there are points. Part of the point here is that there are systems that don't get more diverse if they're set up in the wrong way, right? So one of the questions that I talk about a lot in the book is, you know, why has the web been so innovative in such a short amount of time? It's evolved into all these new spaces that Tim Berners-Lee didn't dream of, you know, 20 years
ago,
right? At an amazing rate, much faster than any other medium in the past. And part of that is because there are so many minds involved in the problem of trying to figure out what you can do with this form. So if you have a limited cultural space where it's very top-down, where there's one leader who says, as the Chinese did, you know, no more ships. We're into the shipping business, but we're done with ships. I'm over ships. Nobody can build ships anymore. That will hurt your society's ability to explore the adjacent possible of what it can do because somebody's in control and they control everything. But when you have a system that's organized from below, like the web, and when you have a lot of people on the platform experimenting, you get an increase in diversity. Now, the tricky thing, the thing that I think, you know, kind of cultural critics and media critics have a hard time understanding is when you talk about the general tendency of the system, there's this kind of desire to say, is it getting better or is it getting worse? Right? And the answer is really, it's just getting more diverse. And that's an important difference, right? It means there is more awful stuff and there is more totally brilliant
stuff.
Yeah,
to say it's more diverse is just to say that every time I try to put a charger into my telephone, my wife's charger doesn't work because it's so diverse with the chargers that I can't find one that will... It's not necessarily a good thing.
It's not always a good thing. It depends on the kind of filtering mechanisms you have to weed out the bad things or your skills with the chargers and things like that. But what it means, you're just thinking
well,
your marriage...
You
if you
slide
want to
them in there, don't you?
But... You know, if we're in general, I think that the general success of society has come when we get to spaces where there's a lot of experimentation, where there are more people exploring the edges of possibility, and it leads to, you know, it's like with cities, which I talk about in the book as well. Cities are great spaces of innovation because there are a lot of people next to each other sharing ideas. It makes it a great environment for criminals. Crime has always thrived in cities because the criminals are able to be more innovative at their trade, just as the pornographers are able to be more innovative at their trade on the web. I think as a society we've decided that we're all better off in the long run if we do create environments that encourage innovation, even if the cost of that is bad people being more innovative at the things that they do.
I think there actually, it's not just that it's getting more diverse and that's all you can say about it. I think there really is a movement, a direction towards good.
Biologists, if you went to any really good orthodox Darwinian, they would tell you that there's no purpose to evolution,
right,
that there's no goal and there's no end.
They're wrong. So, and I'm not the only one saying that. There are
orthodox was the right word.
Orthodox is the word. There are renegade,
your
magical
Conway
young,
Morris's, those guys?
Those guys. Yeah. There are legitimate evolutionary biologists who recognize what we all intuitively understand, which is that if you look at 4 billion years of life, you can say, oh my gosh, things are getting more complex, more
but
diverse.
The only reason there, look, if you start out as a little itty-bitty thing, there's a huge amount of
that's
room
right
to become bigger and more complex
right
and large, but there's not a lot of space between you and smaller.
Sure. Right.
So obviously things are going to grow more complex, but that doesn't
right
mean that they want to. It just means that that's where the room is.
That's right. That's called the drunken walk theory,
thing,
which is that if you have a wall here, which is a wall, which is it can't be any simpler, you can only go this way,
yeah,
which is true for a lot. However, if you get away from the wall, in theory, you would find life going back towards the wall. If after a million or a billion years, you would say, well, you could have just as easily, the evolution would work backwards to simplification, right? Once you're away from the wall, but we don't see that. We actually see a trend in general towards more complexity even once you get away from, so in other words, we rarely see complex organisms simplify.
Here's another way. Robert, let me try this.
Yeah.
We're going to win here, right? So, So the one very active evolutionary theory debate is something like the inevitability of evolution, given enough time, evolving eyes, right? Yes. Light is the fastest way to transmit information, and so the idea is that given enough evolutionary time, creatures would evolve the ability to kind of process and make sense of light and to somehow kind of act on that information, right? Mm-hmm. And it turns out what we find when we go back is that eyes independently evolved multiple times in completely different lines because there was just something about the physics of the world that made that, despite the fact that evolution didn't on some level want to, there was no intelligent designer saying eyes would be good, light waves move very fast, that would be a good thing to do. But evolution kept stumbling its way towards that innovation on these separate paths. Okay. And I think that's where I 100% agree with Kevin.
No one says that eyes wanted to be there. No one said that there was a niche called the eye niche waiting for eyes.
The very serious question, which I think is real, is then how do you describe that? How do you describe that inevitability of a system not being directed, somehow ending up again and again? If you rewound the tape and ran it again, you would have eyes. Eyes would just keep showing up. So Kevin, I think, has picked this provocative but I think useful way of describing it, which is that there is this tendency of that system to go towards those attractors. There are kind of magnets that the system will gravitate towards.
But look what he's done. He's added spoons.
No, so but spoons are the point. Eventually, people will invent spoons as well. Spoons are an attractor.
So, Robert, the spoons will get together.
Why are you obsessed? Why does this bother you so much? I mean,
because reason that you are crossing a line here. You are saying that living systems, which have a logic, which he describes very well, have that the logic of living systems also belongs to these inanimate things.
Right.
And that here's where
does
it
that
seems,
scare you, spook
well,
you, worry you?
Let me read to you what let me read to you what some of your reviewers have said.
Kelly's central thesis is this: technology has its own internal logic and rhythms that are distinct and sometimes adverse to the desires of the humans that create it. Technology creates itself using humans to do its bidding. Or, technologies follow courses that humans can influence and see gross forms of, but humans cannot direct or prevent technology's course, at least not in the long run. Like water contained behind a dam, relentlessly seeking escape, technology will eventually find its own way. Now, doesn't that creep you out a little?
No,
I
know.
I'm seriously,
it's like if you said the same thing about life, would that bother you?
No, I'm part of life. I'm just worried about the thing.
No, you're part of technology, too. Don't you understand that we humans have invented ourselves? That you know, we have this external stomach we call cooking that has changed our diets, that has changed our teeth, our jaws. We have remade ourselves. When we become literate, our brains are rewired. We think differently. We're not the same people that left Africa. We have domesticated ourselves. We are going to continue doing that. So why is that? You are technology. Does that bother you?
Well, but when you say, what does technology want, I'm not sure I'm in that sentence. That's what creeps me out. What would happen if, by your logic, and maybe as a fellow traveler by your logic, you could imagine a situation where the things that we have created, not only our ideas, but the things we have made, will have, by the same processes that describe the evolution of life, will have developed a will of their own, and then there will be either a evolution at our command, or an evolution away from us, or a revolution, an evolution that might somehow compete with us. I don't know. Yeah, there is a seed of something very...
So we have some experience with that. They're called children. We're self-replicating. There they are. They can do tremendous harm. They're going to grow up into powerful beings. They could do harm. They could do good. They could self-replicate and have children of their own. They could go many, many generations out of our control. Aren't you frightened by that?
No, because as odd as children are sometimes, they have a deep familiarity. I kind of understand the nature, the biological nature.
And that's
nature.
Why I wrote this book, because I think it's essential that we understand the nature of technology so that we can begin to train it. Because it's our mind child, and we're making this stuff, and it has some autonomy. And so we have to understand the nature of this technium so that we can let it go.
And to some extent, aren't we already in that kind of imagined future state? I mean, you think about the internet right now. If we wanted to turn it off, it would be extremely difficult to do.
It's impossible.
Yeah, I mean, and if we did, the catastrophic, nonlinear, unpredictable effects of turning this thing off would be unbelievably devastating, right? We would have no idea what would happen. All the things that would break if the internet was off
at that point. Would we be turning off something we use, something we need? But at the moment when, I don't know where this gets this far, but at the moment when to turn off the machine is to commit a murder, that is that the machine would have come somehow sentient or full of feeling, but that would be very
Kevin
morally troubling.
But Kevin is very
troubling.
Clear also to defend him again. He's, when you say want, and this is the danger of want, right? Because he's not talking about consciousness. He's not talking about
well, not
sentence,
yet.
Right. And it's like in the sense that you would say, you know, a little bacterium, you know, wants to kind of float up a nutrient stream or something like that, right? The bacterium presumably is not conscious of what it is doing. It's not sitting there saying like, yummy nutrients here. This is great. If I only had a spoon, you know, it's not thinking like that, right? But nonetheless, you have to look at it and say it is happy going up this little gradient, sucking in all these nutrients, and somehow that thing is driven towards that. And so maybe the problem is we don't quite have that. I want, but there's no I.
Right.
We don't have the kind of the verb or maybe the subject.
I use want, you know, provocatively and deliberately, but partly so that we can rehearse this idea as things acquire more autonomy. Right now, the amount of autonomy in the things that we make is minuscule. It's about the size of a bacteria or a grasshopper, but it won't be. It will increase, and so we have to prepare ourselves for the fact that someday we're going to make something that will have a want. And how do we deal with that? When we make something that, you know, declares to us, oh, I am a child of God, what's our response to it? And so I use want to help us really prepare ourselves for that eventuality.
Well, let me go just to retreat back to safer ground for a second. In your book, and in both of your books, actually, you pause at the nature of cities. I mean, if technology does invite certain kinds of environments or seems to thrive in certain kinds of environments, both of you seem to think that cities have a particularly special role. What is that role?
Well, there's a really interesting study done a couple of years ago by this guy, Jeffrey West, who used to run the Santa Fe Institute, where he went back and looked at, in a sense, talking to Kevin's point about superorganisms, to look at the metabolism of big cities as they grew bigger and tried to figure out, there's a basic law in biology that as organisms grow bigger, they slow down, their heartbeats slow down.
Yes.
And he tried to figure out if that was true of cities. And what he found was this very interesting thing, that it was actually true of things like electrical infrastructure and things like that. But the surprising result, the result that actually breaks from biology in some sense, is that as cities grew larger, they grew disproportionately more innovative. So measured
basically
by things like
inside cities got quicker instead of bigger quicker.
And not just a city that was 10 times larger than another city was 30 times more innovative. It generated more patents. It had more creative arts. It did all these, you know, they had like 6 or 7 measures of innovation. So the bigger the city gets, it gets kind of in a positive quarter power law scaling, which we don't need to get into, but it goes like this. So, you know, the funny thing about that is you would think, okay, having good ideas, thinking good ideas, that would be something that would require a lot of quiet contemplation and isolating yourself and not being distracted and a lot of noise and all that kind of stuff would not be good for coming up with good ideas. And in fact, the exact opposite happens, right? It's cities where tremendous kind of idea generation spaces seem to happen. If you go back to the early origins of cities, there's a tremendous explosion in invention that happens right after the first cities form, which Kevin writes about as well. And the answer to that is everything we've been talking about, in a sense, that the cities create an environment where, as economists like to say, there's information spillover, where ideas, because people are densely packed together, they're hanging out, somebody comes up with a good idea, and it just flows, like the water breaking through the dam, into somebody else's mind, and they say, hey, that's great, I'll take that, and you're a plumber, but you've got your loom, and you've got your punch cards, that's fantastic, I think I might take that and go try and build a programmable computer. And it's that close proximity and the unlikely kind of collisions that happen in that environment that makes it such a kind of profound idea.
Is that why cities are growing? Because people who live on farms all over the world say, I hate my father telling me what to do. I hate my older brother coming. I'm leaving here and I'm going to Shanghai and I'm going to make my own.
Yes, because the homes that they're leaving are they're beautiful. They're in majestic places. They have a very strong family support. It's very satisfying. They're probably eating organic food. They're incredible lifestyles. And
I'm thinking of some poor Chinese woman, actually, but you know, well, she could be living in a beautiful place with an incredible organic lifestyle.
No, they're Greek islands. Where are they coming from? They're coming from these places that other tourists are going to pay a lot of money to visit, and they're streaming into the cities that are ghettos and slums and have very little running water nearby, and to our eyes look completely horrible, but from their eyes. They're moving because they have increasing choices and options. As beautiful as those old homes were, the cost of that satisfaction was the fact that they had reduced choices and options. And the cities offer that at the cost of these horrible living conditions otherwise. But they have the opportunity for education, the opportunity for a different job than just hoeing beans, the opportunity for their children to have a better life. And so they come in because cities, as technology and as all technologies do, they increase our options and choices, which is why I say that the thread of technology, the stream of it, the arc of it, is a good because it's constantly increasing possibilities, choices, options.
Well, I hate to rain on your guys' parade, but let me just give you a small little cloud over this picture. So here you get these cities, like 30% of the world lives in cities, then 40%, then 50%,
right.
And in the next generation, maybe 80%.
Right.
Okay. That's a lot of people moving to cities. So what happens in cities? In cities, you learn that life is more than just tuna fish on rye. Oh, there's something called a Niçoise olive. You think, I'd like to have a Niçoise olive. And you learn to order Niçoise olives, and then you learn to order Bulgarian celery or something. And all of a sudden, planes have to fly around so that you can go to your restaurant in Shanghai or your restaurant in Nairobi or your restaurant in Manhattan to order these things. So now there's a sort of secret carbon sort of concept. So what happens when you go to cities is, yes, people get more choices, but what if they actually want those choices in their mouths, on their backs, in their houses? Then they start ordering stuff, and then the world becomes a place where instead of 2 billion people who have lots of furniture and lots of cool food, you have 3 billion and 4 billion. What? Is there any
thought? But if you're going to be in a planet with 4, 5, 6, 7 billion people, it's far more efficient from an environmental perspective to put them all in cities.
If you're looking at their transportation, they're all walking to work. But what about the Niçoise olive? There are now,
we can afford the olives because we're all walking to work.
Can the planet? Isn't there, in the happy picture that you paint, isn't there a question about what, are you sure that this is affordable in the global sense?
Right, and so can the carrying capacity of the natural system support this technological, technosphere, the technium? And the answer is, I think that for every technology that we can imagine that's not working, we can imagine a greener version of it that can work. So this is really the only solution, because when you have a bad idea, the response to a bad idea is not to think less, but it's to have a better idea. And the response to a technology that's maybe environmentally not very good, is not to have less technology, but to have a better technology. So we can innovate and make technologies that impact less, that are greener in every case. And so that's what we should be doing, not making less, not thinking less, not having less ideas, not having less technology, but having better.
Well, let me just say
one other thing about cities. It's important in the way you formulated the question. If you look at the pattern of urbanization over the last 150 or 200 years, probably the single biggest, the most important kind of demographic trend beneath that macro trend, which is probably the single most important trend on the planet in terms of human society, is the fact that when people move to cities, they have markedly fewer children. So it's not just that we're packing all the people together, but it's actually when people move to the city, they stop having 8 kids and they have 2 kids. Or in the case of places that have been urban for very long periods of time, like, say, Italy, they have less than two kids, and their population actually starts shrinking. So there's an argument, if you want to get kind of self-organizing and kind of planetary in scope, in the sense is that the invention of the city is this long-term kind of population control mechanism that the human beings have kind of spontaneously hit upon without even realizing it.
Well, let me see if I can read.
I'm just getting all Kevin Kelly here, no, just
right,
at the end of it.
No, but all right, so let me just, I'll give you one last salvo here. Where did these brilliant ideas come from? If you have a billion people on the planet and you have three really remarkable minds who know 700 really facilitating minds, who know 3,000 really ingenious engineers who can put those ideas to work, that's good. But if you have 5 billion people, then you have a few more generative ideas. How much does rescuing ourselves with new ideas depend on how many of us there are? If we were to go, as he just suggests, mm-hmm. from a planet of 9 billion to 8 billion to 7 billion to 6 billion, if women are not replacing them, then you're going to have fewer people. Will that cut the engine of ingenuity or no?
That is my great worry. I really worry about the population explosion that happens on implosion that happens on the other side of 2050. You always see these graphs of the peak, but they never show you what's happening on the other side of the peak. And that's because, as far as we can tell, it just kind of goes down, 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 down. And here's why that's a problem, is because all our experiences in history so far, whenever we've seen rising living standards, they've always been associated with increasing population. And so you have increasing population and decreasing standards, but we never have increasing standards with decreasing population. And so we are looking at a world in the future where every year there will be fewer people, a smaller market, fewer minds, and we have no experience in making an economy that works that way. I'm not saying that we can't do it. It's very hard to imagine how you would do it where every year.
I know how you do it.
Well, but
thinking spoons.
Okay.
You get these spoons, they
well,
get brains.
Well, that's one solution, is that you just make artificial minds and you fill up the world with a population of explosions of artificial minds. That's possible. But
no, you're really...
I'm really concerned because if you think through that, well, like, you know, I'm doing whatever I'm doing and I have this audience or I have these people who are interested in it, and next year there's half as many or maybe one less, whatever it is, and it goes on. And every year there's fewer and fewer people to support what I do or be interested in what I do or help me do what I do, and fewer ideas. It's very hard to imagine how that's really good and wonderful.
Well, Stephen's book suggests one way out, which is if you abandon the habit of protective thinking, so if you fire your lawyers, get rid of your patent laws, open up the windows and doors of that there will be, that a fewer number of people might be able, that ideas might flow. You seem to be very libertarian in this regard.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, it's funny. We in part started with Malthus and Darwin, and of course this idea of kind of runaway deadly population growth, talk about the power of an idea. That's kind of starts with Malthus, and it's animated the way that we've thought about the future for 200 years. And in fact, parts of it were right and parts of it were wrong. The population did grow even faster than we thought, but in fact, our technology has continued to keep up with that growth and exceed it, and standards have risen dramatically over that whole period. So he was fundamentally wrong, but we keep trying to apply that model and keep waiting for it to kick in. And I think Kevin's right that what happens on the other end of that is something that Malthus didn't see at all, and that we really don't have any equipment for kind of thinking about it. But I think you're right on some sense in that the measure is not the total number of minds on the planet. The measure is the total number of minds who are connected to each other and who have an active kind of stake in coming up with solutions to problems that mm-hmm. they confront. And it seems to me that the absolute number of those people and the absolute number of connections between those people could still grow dramatically through a population implosion for a while, because you have more, in a sense, you have more minds kind of coming online, being able to communicate their ideas to people on the other side of the planet. And so as long as that process is going on, we should have a steady increase in our capacity to solve problems and our ability to come up with new solutions to problems that arise that we haven't anticipated yet.
I'll conclude. Let's see. Oh, 9:30. When do we start this? We're running a little late.
Yeah, we kind of.
And I was going to talk about books and stuff. Well, let me finish with this note. You're like one of the happiest people I know. Because, so I finally made you sad for like 1 minute. But you've often said that in contemplating these future problems, you just seem to always look on from the Life of Brian. Mm. Always look on the bright side of life. In this case, if you were to give the technium a mind of its own, is your thought that it will work out great?
Yes, I think that. What evolution moves towards is increasing sentience of all sorts. So we see that, we see throughout life, mind being invented all the time. I think what we are doing is we're kind of evolution's way to invent minds that biological evolution could not make. So we're going to invent all kinds of ways of thinking that evolution, in a biological sense, could not reach. And the reason why we're doing to do that is we're going to invent all kinds of mind, different kinds of thinking, because our mind alone is probably not sufficient to completely comprehend the universe. We need other species of thinking. So we're going to populate the universe as far as we can with other ways of thinking so that collectively we can comprehend the universe. And those other ways of thinking are ways that biological evolution probably couldn't get to itself. So I think that, yes, the more kinds of minds there are, the better, not just the more minds.
And does this echo in any way the somewhat daffy ideas of Ray Kurzweil, like who thinks that there's this singularity coming up?
No, actually, I'm not a fan of the singularity. Because, first of all, it's his timeline and stuff, and I think the singularity is sort of an illusionary. There's something that you only see
in
retrospect.
This, by the way, means that at a certain point, the machines get smart enough that they don't need us anymore.
Right. The idea that you make an AI that's smarter than you, that makes an AI that's smarter than it, that makes an AI, and then suddenly you have God. And I think that that's what I call thinkism. Thinkism is this idea that you can solve problems just by thinking about them. So this idea that once you have something smart, you can solve all these problems that actually take years and years of investigation and experiment and things like longevity. So Ray's idea is that once you have this super thinking, they'll just figure out how we live forever. But you just don't figure that out by thinking. You have to actually do experiments. You actually have to interact with the real world. So these guys like to think, so they think the solution to everything is just thinking about them, and I don't think that's really true.
And how happy how happy are you?
I feel great.
You? Thanks for asking.
I mean, just thinking for. This makes me a little nervous, this whole conversation, honestly. I don't know quite why that is. I mean, I once was assigned by ABC to go around with Donald Trump for a few days, and this guy, like, you know, we're walking around, and he's thinking, oh my God, we could build something over there. It would be fantastic. It would be, you know, a hotel with a. And I'm thinking, what about the fact that the subway, what about the. And he looks at me and says, you could never be in real estate. So maybe I could never be a future oligologist.
I'm reminding you of Trump. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's not a bad thing. I mean, he dreams, and then he you know, he's kind of a weird guy, but he dreams well, and you know, and he puts his dreams to work. So my last question to you is like, so he's sort of, you know, he always is dancing. I don't know about you. Are you worry about anything? Does this whole thing just seem to you benign? That is, the technium and its slow evolution into something like sentience?
Well, when Kevin and I talked a little bit earlier this summer, I was asking him, because there is this feeling of once the systems are out of control, even if they're not sentient, I agree that the singularity is not the right way to think about it, but there is this feeling of surrendering of kind of human agency and human ability to kind of stop things that might somehow get out of control. And there are a bunch of kind of doomsday scenarios out there. And Kevin, I think, kind of persuaded me that we should be less worried about them than we are. But the truth is, when you involve more minds who can really participate and are connected to each other, it also means that there some portion of that population has evil intents and they're more empowered. There's a kind of asymmetrical warfare argument there, which we've seen certainly in recent years. And so...
That's what I think about. I think people have a dual nature. People oftentimes, even bad people, like to do good some of the time,
yeah.
But they also like to do bad. And this business of making everything more powerful and more leveraged means that both things become more dramatic.
That's right.
The good and the bad.
Right. Technology is not powerful unless it can be powerfully abused.
Right.
And it will be. But I think as long as we can create 0.1% more than we destroy every year, we get civilization, because 1% compounded over centuries is what we have. So the world doesn't have to be that much. It could be slightly better.
I think part
really
of the problem
good.
Is when you're saying, are we going to be okay? Kevin is saying, absolutely, on the 10,000-year scale. We're going to be great.
And but you're next
saying,
year...
But what about next Tuesday?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Both are valid concerns.
Well, there's a happy ending. Here's what we could do. I could let you all go, and then they're going to sign books. That seems sensible. If you want, I could have... how many of you are desperate to ask questions? Not enough of you. Okay, they're going to have a book signing right now. So I don't know where. Is that over there?
Right over there.
Yeah, so each of these guys, so the lights will come on, they will go to their book signing. And thank you all very, very much for coming.